Today on Wings, the topic is a new film about U.S. women's history of organizing for welfare rights, Storming Caesar's Palace, produced and directed by Hazel Gerland.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Here's Wings contributing producer Lisa Hayes.
Wings reporter Ann Lewis interviewed filmmaker Hazel Gerland about her documentary film titled Storming Caesar's Palace. Hazel Gerland was inspired by the book Storming Caesar's Palace by author and historian Annalise Orlek, who is also in the film. Here's Ann Lewis.
Let's talk a little bit about what brought you to the subject.
I had been very interested in Black history and gender studies for a long time.
When Hazel Gerland attended Bard College, she discovered the work of Ida B. Wells.
What I found so exciting was that she was able to break down not only the racist sort of tropes that existed at the time that sort of justified lynching, like, oh, you know, Black men are rapists and white women are chaste, but also showed that was totally a construct that had been created in society. And I just became so interested in that and the womanist aspect of it, where women of color, and particularly Black women, are constantly fighting at this sort of intersection between race and gender. She wanted to work as a civil rights sort of activist, but Black male leaders of her time were sort of like, no, you know, you're a woman, you should just, you know, hang back. We've got this. We're going to take care of the race aspect of it first. And then when she went to white feminists who were fighting for the right to vote and things like that, they're like, well, you know, let's just get the woman thing taken care of. You should just wait. So I thought about that and was really interested in trying to shine spotlights on women in more recent history who fight against racism and sexism that's created and is structural. And when I read the book, Storming Caesar's Palace by Annalise Orlek, I just thought, wow, these women are sort of today's Ida B. Wells's, I guess, in a weird way. Ruby Duncan in particular, who I ended up really focusing on for a number of reasons in the film. But, you know, she's obviously a part of a much larger group of women in the National Welfare Rights Organization and in the Clark County Welfare Rights group that they had in Las Vegas. They were fighting those tropes, like, who is the welfare queen? You know, the lazy Black woman who's got all these kids and is just having them to get welfare money, and she doesn't want to get a job, and she's driving a Cadillac and eating steaks, and all these totally outrageous stereotypes and tropes was just that. It's not obviously real because you can't make enough money to live on, but also because they were trying to work and they were trying to reform the welfare system and try to make changes. So they were working all the time and they tried to get jobs and often couldn't get them for various reasons as well. So I was just instantly enamored with the struggle and successes that these women had. And I just felt like they were such visionaries.
Hazel Gerland's film, Storming Caesar's Palace, centers around the activism of Ruby Duncan and several leaders of the Clark County Welfare Mothers Organization. Because of domestic violence and the Jim Crow South, Ruby Duncan moved to Las Vegas for better opportunities for her and her seven children. She was injured on the job, which forced her to go on welfare. She soon found that the assistance from the welfare office wasn't enough for her to take care of her family. Here's a clip from the film. This is Ruby Duncan.
We were only getting like $120, and we had to pay $60 for rent. It was not enough money to really live.
At one point during the interview, Ruby Duncan's daughter, Sandra Phillips Gilbert, shares a memory.
Mama, do you remember? I never forgot this. You would buy a hamburger. Oh, my God. Mm-hmm. And Mama, I said, Mama, can I get a bite? And you took that one hamburger and you shared it with all seven of us. It was amazing.
We just couldn't take a big bite.
Yeah, I mean, I remember just biting, and you bite, then I bite, then everybody bit, and you just had
not such a big bite.
I thought
because we were too poor, we didn't have any money. We was on welfare and the county commodities, which were government cheese. And
not to be sold or exchanged.
There you go. We seriously didn't have anything to eat. Because that's when I was making up cornbread with just plain water and flour and frying it with Vaseline.
Wings reporter Ann Lewis and filmmaker Hazel Gurland discussed the sewing circle as a catalyst to Ruby Duncan's involvement with the Clark County Welfare Mothers Organization. Here's Ann Lewis.
I love that she just kind of falls in through the sewing program, that it's not like coming to change the world.
Yeah, I mean, it's very sort of organic in that way. The sewing circle scene, you know, in the film, but also in real life, was where these women were able to talk to one another. And they were able to share intimate stories about their backgrounds, the abusive men they had left, the sexual assault that they had endured, the things that they had to struggle through and come out of. A lot of the women had been from sort of the Jim Crow South, so there was a lot of cultural stuff that was happening around them and to their families as well. Yeah, the sewing circle was a place where they started to talk to each other. And in that talking, there's sort of that consciousness raising that happens. And they were like, wait a minute, I'm not the only one who had this problem. And then it's sort of what Gloria Steinem says, you know, there's one group of people says this, and you realize there's even more people. And then you realize it's about power, and you can come together and you can change it. I think it really was an empowering place for them, because they were able to realize, like, oh, this is something that the Nevada welfare system is doing to us, probably on purpose. And now we can come up with ways to combat it together as a group.
Ann Lewis and filmmaker Hazel Gurland discuss centering women of color and using their voices. Here's Ann Lewis.
You introduce the tropes with famous people, and all of your scholars are women, right? All of the people that give us some historic background are women. So this is a very courageous film in a way. But I think that deep examination of the tropes forces us as an audience to examine those things deeply and not just enjoy the wonders of this really, truly wonderful subject.
Filmmaker Hazel Gurland.
Definitely. I really, really wanted to center this film on Ruby and on Mary Wesley and Alversa Beals. It was important that even though it does end up being mostly about Ruby, because in your film, you sort of need to focus and follow one person. I think it gets a little too complicated if there's just too many people, but it was important for me that it also be clear that this was a women's movement, that there were women across the country. She obviously didn't do this alone and couldn't have done it alone. So it was important that we see some of the other women and a little bit of their backstories as well. And it was important to me that, you know, women scholars be the people who also are scholars. Like, they're the people who also know this history. Like, we don't need to turn to somebody else to tell us that. And I tried as much as possible to have mostly be, you know, women of color who were in the film as well. Obviously, interviewed Annalise Orlek because she was the author of the book, and Gloria Steinem. She's the other kind of exception. And I really struggled actually with that a little bit, because I didn't want white women to be the people who have to explain what Black women were doing. Ruby and the other women are perfectly capable of telling their own story and explaining, you know, they are the experts on these things.
In her career as a documentary filmmaker, Hazel Gurland worked on films for and centering white men. So she intentionally centered her film around women of color and quickly ran into challenges that delayed the production.
It took me like 15 years to make this film. And some of that was just trying to actually make it. But a lot of it was fundraising and convincing other people that this story was important and should be told.
Hazel Gurland speaks of being born in Bogota, Colombia, and being adopted by a wealthy American family.
So I was born in Colombia. I was left at an orphanage there and ultimately very fortunate to be adopted by an American family of means who were able to send me to good schools and things like that. And so, you know, I feel not just sort of an obligation, but a real passion for sharing the stories of women, particularly mothers of color. There is something about, you know, wishing in some ways that I had known my birth mother and feeling like if we lived in a different world, she wouldn't maybe have had to make that choice to sort of give me up. And I think really getting into Ruby's story and that of all of these mothers, the fight that they had taking on the system in order to provide a safe home environment and nutritious food and clothing and everything for their kids. So it was sort of like, I think Ruby in some ways became my sort of mom. Like, I have to tell this story. And people were like, yeah, but why? And I was like, oh, it took a while to come to this.
On Wings, you're listening to an interview with Hazel Gurland, producer and director of the 2023 documentary Storming Caesar's Palace, about the welfare rights movement in the U.S. and especially the pivotal roles of Ruby Duncan and other welfare recipients in Nevada in confronting the especially cruel system there. The interview was conducted by documentary filmmaker Ann Lewis. Our Wings program with excerpts from the interview and from the film is edited and narrated by Lisa Hayes.
Ann Lewis asks Hazel Gurland about the man in house rule.
What was the man in the house rule?
The man in the house rule was a rule where if there was a man who lived in the home or was spending time in the home, then the welfare department felt that they should be able to provide for the kids. And so the women would be cut off from public assistance if there was any evidence of a man being around. And so caseworkers were very slick. They would show up in the middle of the night. They would come when there might be a gentleman caller. I think Mary Manning says it really well in the film. She was like, you know, the Constitution was left on the doorstep. Part of search and seizure. You can't do that. And so the women fought really hard against it. And a lot of the women were almost taken off because they had sons who were like 14 years old and had young men's shoes in the house. Annalise Orlek tells us that she learned from social workers that George Miller had said that these social workers should go in with loaded guns, which is horrifying because then, you know, some kid could jump out and then someone will get shot. So I think the idea that these homes wouldn't be safe places also speaks to kind of, you know, racist ideas that the welfare department had. Like, if these were white women going into these like low-income Black houses, you have to have a gun with you. All that does is make the whole situation less safe. Yeah, but luckily that was struck down by the Supreme Court because a number of women sued.
Here's Ruby Duncan.
We didn't know when they were coming knocking on our door, and so we sued them for it.
On June 17, 1968, the Supreme Court struck down the man-in-house rule because it violated the U.S. Constitution. Here's Annalise Orlek, the author of Storming Caesar's Palace.
Nothing was celebrated more heartily than the King v. Smith decision, a Supreme Court decision ending the hated man-in-the-house rule.
We had won that victory. We see now the system do listen once you come out in numbers.
In 1968, George Miller was appointed Welfare Director of Nevada. Miller shows up in the film as someone who creates policy that targeted welfare mothers, such as purging the names on the welfare rolls, blocking access to food stamps, and attempting to close the community center that the welfare mothers organized and ran. Here's Hazel Gurland.
Our nemesis in the film, George Miller, had a gendered notion of what the welfare system was supposed to be for. It was supposed to be for giving it to the heads of households, giving it to men so that they could then get their families together and change things. Because women having children out of wedlock and families falling apart was a big issue that everybody was talking about in the 60s, like Moynihan and other people that we see in the film. And Black women are the ones being vilified for that. So I think that was another moment where I was trying to gently, but clearly, break down another myth.
In 1966, George Wiley led the first ever nationwide welfare rights protest and became the executive director of the National Welfare Rights Organization. In 1968, Ruby Duncan became president of the Clark County Welfare Rights Organization. She also discovers the National Welfare Rights Organization and garnered their support for future protest actions.
One day, I seen this big paper laying there and saying, National Welfare Rights. I said, what in the world? And I began to reading. So my God, people doing this all over the country. In L.A., they call themselves welfare mamas. Johnny Tillman.
We couldn't care less about making you mad because we have been mad over a period of years.
In New York City, it was Beulah Saunders.
Our people ain't gonna starve, and we ain't about to see them starve. We're gonna get food and clothing and shelter one way or the other.
They were bad. Oh, I wanted to be like them so bad. They picked a person from every state as the delegate. I was from Nevada. We would meet every month.
We come together at a time of unprecedented repression against poor people. We come together at a time when we have opportunities for organizing and for building our strength as never before.
George Wiley will be talking to us from 6 o'clock in the evening all the way to 3 o'clock in the morning. He wouldn't let us go to sleep. He said, you got to know.
Nixon doesn't care about poor children.
Welfare is not geared to help you get on your feet at all. They are there to keep you down.
Beulah Saunders and Johnny Tillman. They were our greatest teachers.
We all know what the poverty program is about. We all know that it's one big lie.
I enjoyed it so much. I learned so much. Political education, to teach community people who's holding the pocketbook and power.
In 1968, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, under the leadership of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Reverend Ralph Abernathy, after initial hesitation, endorsed and supported the National Welfare Rights Movement. Here's Hazel Gurland.
The civil rights movement is often led by men. And during the civil rights movement, it was really important that there kind of be this very proper, nonviolent veneer of the whole thing. Like, it was really important, certainly to Dr. King, that everybody seemed very proper. Rosa Parks was, you know, chosen very specifically to be the person who sat on the bus. There were three other, you know, young women before that who they sort of thought about leading that protest, but one of them had been pregnant when she was like 16. One of them had a drunk uncle or something. And they all knew, like, this is going to get torn apart and we need like the perfect kind of person. And so the civil rights movement was very careful about the people they chose. And so, you know, bringing in women who were on public assistance, I think, seemed like a risky move for the civil rights movement. And I think Dr. King initially was not that supportive of that idea. But I think, you know, to the women's credit, they really pushed him. They called for this meeting and he and Dr. Abernathy, and we see other sort of famous leaders that we know, and they're in the footage as well, sort of show up. And then they admit, you know, this was a learning experience for us. And it doesn't have to only be sort of a middle class or working class movement that poverty is part of the structures that exist in this country. And so, you know, people at all levels have to be fighting for civil rights. Yeah. So I think that was important for me. And I didn't know, you know, I still obviously think incredibly highly of Dr. King. I mean, he's, you know, an incredible leader. But it was great to see that he was able to learn and to be moved by these women. They really pushed.
Milan Brown was the director of legal services.
He had a welfare department that was always trying to put thumb on him under some guise of saving taxpayer money.
So one day, Milan called me and let me know he was going to assign another attorney to us. And that attorney was Jack Anderson.
I looked at it as the Wild West. That George Miller, he was sort of your epitome of backroom politics, cigar smoking, deal making. Ruby Duncan and two other women came to the office. They said they hadn't received their checks. I said, well, did you get a notice? No, there wasn't any notice. I said, that couldn't happen, that's not legal. I'll call the welfare department, get it straightened out. Got a hold of the caseworker. She said, well, they've been terminated. And I said, there's a case just decided this year by the Supreme Court, Goldberg versus Kelly. You have to provide them advance notice of that. And if they want, they can request a fair hearing. No, she says, that's not the way it works in Nevada. Within a few more days, it became clear that thousands of terminations had occurred. Moreover, they had all been terminated illegally. This calls for a class action.
I called George Wiley from the Welfare Rights Organization.
I'm here in Las Vegas today to meet with Ruby Duncan and other leaders of Clark County Welfare Rights Organization.
They all came from everywhere, all over the United States. I wasn't afraid of nothing. I have 7 children, and they got to be fed. And we began to go on a trip. The police was over here. Just rows of them driving. When we turned off into Caesar's Palace, the police said, where are they going now?
Perhaps 1,000 marchers flooded into Caesar's Palace, one of the most luxurious resort hotels.
Here's Annalise Orlick, the author of Storming Caesar's Palace.
The economic impact was huge. They literally shut down gambling for a certain length of time.
Here's Ann Lewis.
They walk into the casinos and defy the mob in a way, shut down the casinos. They then take their kids to eat at probably what was being given away to gamblers, the food, but they eat steak and lobster with their kids.
Absolutely. They were incredibly creative and media savvy about everything that they were doing. They knew that they were in Las Vegas, where all of the money from the casinos is being funneled to the legislature and to the lawmakers, and that that was the place to have a disruptive action, which would then put pressure and like remind everybody like who actually has the power. The people power, mother power, poor people power is what is running this country. And if we all just suddenly stop, like if all the care workers just didn't show up, everybody would completely freak out and something would have to happen.
February 8, 1972, the federal government gave state funds for food stamp programs for the poor. But Nevada was the only state in the nation that resisted this resource for its citizens. Poor children were not getting enough food, and many were developing diseases like rickets as a result. The Clark County Welfare Rights Organization responded in protest by conducting an eat-in in which the children of poor families were bused to a restaurant at the Flamingo Hotel. They were told to order anything on the menu, and when the time came to pay, Ruby Duncan said, "Bill it to the governor." The adults were arrested. The Nevada legislature voted to have the food stamp program after Ruby Duncan lobbied by arguing that the supermarkets will make more money. In July of 1972, the National Welfare Rights Organization organized large protest rallies during the Democratic Convention in Florida. They were trying to get a guaranteed income of $6,500 per year on the agenda, but that was not successful. However, on the way back, Ruby Duncan had an idea to share with the Nevada welfare organizations to create a central place that poor people can go to get their social services needs met that would be run for and by welfare mothers. In 1972, the organization found grants to lease the Old Cove Hotel building in the part of town where the blacks lived during segregation. People like Sammy Davis Jr., Louis Armstrong, Lena Horne, and others performed at the casinos but weren't allowed to stay there, so they came to the Cove Hotel to perform and have jam sessions and stay in rooms there. This building was abandoned, and when the welfare mothers leased it, they named it Operation Life. On June 30, 1974, the Operation Life building was opened to serve the community. Operation Life had a free clinic, library, child care, and the mothers were administrators and took accurate account of the funds. In 1976, George Miller padlocked the Operation Life building and charged Ruby Duncan and other administrators with welfare fraud. The judge couldn't find evidence of fraud, so the case was dropped. Ruby Duncan.
I think they felt like us being with their moms, and the majority of us didn't have an education. How the hell did you know how to keep up paperwork, manage the money?
September 24, 1979, Ruby Duncan was appointed to the National Advisory Council on Economic Opportunity in President Jimmy Carter's administration. Here's Ruby Duncan.
My advice for poor women in this country, you gotta get out and talk about your problem. You gotta be strong. Don't take no for an answer.
Filmmaker Hazel Gurland.
Ruby always says, we can do it and we can do it better. This woman who had been a sharecropper growing up, missing school, she didn't graduate from, you know, ninth grade, but she ends up in President Jimmy Carter's administration, like helping and advising on economics and poverty and stuff like that. And it's just incredible to realize that if you really put your mind to it and try really hard, you have to be tenacious for sure. You can achieve anything, no matter where you've come from. And I think there's something very inspiring about that.
For Wings, I'm Lisa Hayes.
This program was produced by Lisa Hayes, based on Ann Lewis's interview with filmmaker Hazel Gurland, and audio from Gurland's documentary, Storming Caesar's Palace. Wings thanks our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose works can be found through the website maternalgifteconomymovement.org. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Wings series producer Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.